shortly.
Okay.
It's Brian Lawson. And he's coming on now.
Good morning.
Hey, Hal.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Good. Hey, friend.
Pretty good. Happy holidays to you.
Brother.
How you be?
I'm doing okay. You know, we went to Florida last weekend to visit my friend. Lives in Stuart. So it was nice. We played golf on Friday, but we went to the Everglades on Saturday, and that what an experience! we walked in Hanga Trail or whatever. It was really cool.
So I was in Florida. I was in Florida last Thursday to Monday.
That's what we went Friday and came back Monday.
Yeah, I was in Orlando for my golf trip.
Oh! How was it?
It was great.
Yeah.
Really was.
Cool. What'd you fly down, Hal?
Southwest.
Yeah, that's what we were on. Did you have to go through Atlanta or did you got a direct?
No. Direct flight.
Yeah.
Direct flight.
Too cool.
Yeah. Good morning to everybody else out there, if you're out there.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good
morning. Ah, people are out there. I thought I had the silent majority or something like that. Get started in about 2 minutes, folks. All right, grab a cup of coffee or whatever, T-minus 1 minute. All right. Good morning to everybody. It's Howard Kerman. I hope everybody is well and getting ready for the holiday season. In line with that, as you know, we do these telebriefs on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. Given the fact that the second Wednesday in December is Christmas Eve, the 24th, there will not be a telebrief on the 24th. I know our office is closed as a holiday, and I'm sure that many of you, even if you're not closed, have other things to do that day. So we'll send around a reminder email, but I just wanted to make sure that everybody knows that there will not be a telebrief on the 24th. Rather, the first telebrief after today will be the second Wednesday in January, or January the 14th. So let's start with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has been pretty active in the employment field as recently as yesterday in a significant case and decision that the court handed down yesterday morning, a case called Integrity Staffing Solutions versus Buff. And in line with what the court usually does, in addition to its opinions, it also publishes what's called a syllabus, which is sort of a summary of its decision. And I'll refer to that today or this morning. So in Integrity Staffing Solutions, I'll read from the court syllabus a little. It required its hourly warehouse workers who retrieved products from warehouse shelves and packaged them for delivery to Amazon.com customers to undergo a security screening before leaving the warehouse each day. So in other words, Integrity Staffing Solutions has a contract with Amazon where they essentially employ people to take stuff off the shelves and package them on behalf of Amazon. And at the end of the shift, as the court said, they basically require these employees to go through a security screening, much like you would see in an airport, where they would go through a metal detector to make sure that they're not taking stuff with them along the way. And the employee sued the company, alleging that they were entitled to compensation under the Fair Labor Standards Act for the roughly 25 minutes each day that they spent waiting to undergo and actually undergoing these security screenings. In this case, the federal district court, which is the first level trial court, dismissed the employee's complaint, holding that the screenings were not, in quotes, an integral and indispensable part of the employee's principal activities, which were instead post-liminary and non-compensable. As some of you may know, under what's called the Portal to Portal Act, which is really an amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act, employees are only entitled to time worked or credit for time worked for those activities which are deemed to be a material and indispensable part of their principal duties, and that therefore those duties which are deemed to be preliminary to or post-liminary to their material duties are not compensable. Now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the district court and asserted that these post-shift activities that would ordinarily be classified as non-compensable post-liminary activities were compensable as integral and indispensable to the employee's principal activities, and that therefore, since the employer was requiring them to be done, that the employer should have to pay for that. The Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit and said they were not compensable as post-liminary activities. And what they said, what the Supreme Court said was, and I'll quote, "To begin with, the screenings were not the principal activities the employees were employed to perform, i.e., the workers were employed not to undergo security screenings, but to retrieve products from warehouse shelves and package them for shipment, nor were they integral and indispensable to those activities." And so therefore, what the court held was that these activities, even if they were somehow attached to the end of the shift and amounted to about 25 minutes of the employee shift, would not be deemed to be part of their normal and regular duties, that is, taking goods off of the shelf, packaging them on behalf of Amazon. And essentially what the court said is that because these were post-preliminary activities under the Portal to Portal Act, which again is an amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act, that they would not be compensable. And ostensibly, of course, even if they were preliminary in nature as opposed to post-preliminary in nature. In other words, if you had to go through a security line as you entered the building as opposed to simply when you left the building, ostensibly under the court's reasoning, it would not be compensable at all. So what the court held in the final paragraph of its decision was, we hold that an activity is integral and indispensable to the principal activities that an employee is employed to perform and thus compensable under the FLSA if it is an intrinsic element of those activities and one which the employee cannot dispense if he is to perform his principal activities. Because the employee's time spent waiting to undergo and undergoing integrity staffing security screenings does not meet these criteria, we reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals. So those of you out there who require your employees to go through, go through some security screening, and of course this would only deal with your non-exempt employees as opposed to your exempt employees, because exempt employees, as you know, wouldn't be punching a clock like non-exempt employees would. But for those non-exempt employees, if you have requirements of the employees going through security either prior to a shift or after a shift, under this pronouncement from the Supreme Court in Integrity Staffing Solutions, that would be non-compensable time because it would not be viewed as part of their indispensable and principal work duties. So it's a significant case, and as I said, the decision just was published yesterday. Now, in another significant case that hasn't been decided yet, but that has been argued, the case was argued on December the 3rd. Some of you may have heard about this case. It's named Young versus UPS, United Parcel Service. An oral argument was heard by the Supreme Court on December the 3rd, and the issue in this case is whether an employer violates the Pregnancy Discrimination Act when it offers light duty as an accommodation for workers injured on the job, but doesn't offer such accommodation to pregnant employees with similar work restrictions. The Fourth Circuit, which is the circuit in which Maryland sits and where this case came from, determined that there was not a violation of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act by UPS basically having a policy that said that UPS would accommodate light duty for those workers that were injured on the job, for those workers who had disabilities covered by the ADA, and for those drivers who temporarily lost their Federal Department of Transportation certificate. But the Fourth Circuit basically said that the requirement or the opportunity to get light duty limited to those three circumstances was neutral in nature, that it was not directed at really pregnant employees. It was a neutral policy, basically saying that unless you fell into one of these categories, that is, you have an ADA disability, that you're on workers' comp, or that you are a driver who has temporarily lost your DOT certification, that they would not grant an accommodation for light duty. Now, some of you out there may have light duty policies which only will be accommodated to those people who are those employees who are on workers' compensation injury leaves or temporary total disability leaves. We'll have to see what the Supreme Court does with this. think the Supreme Court, by virtue of the reports of the oral argument held on December 3rd, was struggling with the fact that that the viewpoint of it being either or, that is, either the employee would get the accommodation or the employee would not get an accommodation, struck, I think, several members of the court as being problematic. And I think several members of the court were looking for a middle ground here. Obviously, the liberal members of the court were basically saying that the pregnant employee should be accommodated. The conservative members of the court were struggling with that, basically saying, as Justice Scalia said, that granting pregnant employees such an accommodation would be akin to giving them most favored nation status. Now, you should be aware that in July of this year, the EEOC issued a new enforcement guidance under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, basically indicating that if employers offer light duty to non-pregnant employees with work restrictions, then they're required to grant similar accommodations to pregnant employees who seek those accommodations, or primarily being light duty. I think the Supreme Court is going to struggle a great deal with this case, and it would not surprise me that the decision came down or comes down in sort of a 5-4 decision. But we'll probably be waiting until May or June until we see what the Supreme Court says. In the meantime, those of you who have light duty policies need to be aware that they may have to be modified in view of the Supreme Court's upcoming decision in the UPS case. The third case I want to mention was oral argument heard in the Mock Mining case, which was early this month, in which the Supreme Court heard the issue of how much or how intensive does the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission have to engage in conciliation prior to filing a lawsuit against the company. I've mentioned this a few different times in my telebriefs. Essentially, under Title VII, if the EEOC determines that there is probable cause to believe that discrimination has occurred, it is statutorily bound to require the parties to engage in conciliation. And oftentimes what happens, based on my experience, is the EEOC, as an initial proposal to settle a case, comes up with a ridiculously liberal conciliation proposal, which often the employer could never agree to. And Mock Mining has challenged such a practice and basically indicated in its brief and its argument that prior to the EEOC filing a lawsuit against a company, because of the failure of conciliation, that the EEOC has to demonstrate that it's engaged in good faith conciliation efforts on behalf of the agency. So we won't know again how the Supreme Court comes down on this, probably for another 6 months or so. But those of you who have EEOC charges pending, or where there's already been probable cause to be found that discrimination has occurred, need to be aware that this Mock Mining decision may very well impact on how the Supreme Court, how the EEOC goes about the putative duty and the actual duty that it has under Title VII to engage in conciliation efforts. So those are the Supreme Court developments that have happened really in the first week or two of December. As you all know, I've mentioned the case of Ray Rice several times, and I've predicted to you all along that the NFL would lose in the litigation and in the grievance brought by the Players Association against the NFL. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. But the published decision of the arbitrator in this case also is pretty interesting. And I have read the decision, and I wanted to refer to a couple points in it. This is a decision by the arbitrator, and it was by Barbara Jones. She's a retired federal judge who now works as an arbitrator. And I think that there are several facts in here that did not get published at least in the public media, which I thought I would refer to this morning, because they're interesting and I think that they are reflective of what the NFL did wrong and also instructive of what you all need to do right in your investigations. So in this particular recounting of the facts, as recounted by the arbitrator, Judge Jones, in this case, she mentioned about the incident in February the 15th when Ray Rice, of course, hit his then-fiancée, Janae Palmer. She then says, thereafter on June 16th, Rice met with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell for a pre-discipline meeting. At that meeting, Rice told the commissioner that he had hit Mrs. Rice in the elevator. The NFL knew of the indictment, which, of course, was the Ray Rice criminal indictment in New Jersey, and the results of the criminal proceeding. They had seen the video of Rice's conduct outside the elevator. That's the first video that we all saw, where he dragged her out of the elevator. They, meaning the NFL, had gathered comparator cases of disciplines given for previous violations of the personal conduct policy based on acts of domestic violence. They believed that there was a second video from a camera inside the elevator. Various sources, including NFL security, had reported its existence. Rice had received this video in discovery during his criminal case, but it had not been publicly aired, as had the first video. Then she states the following, which I think is critical. The NFL never asked Rice for the second video. Approximately 1 month after the meeting with Rice, Commissioner Goodell issued a two-game suspension with an additional fine of 1 week's salary. She goes on to say, a firestorm of public criticism followed. In its wake, the commissioner admitted that he, in quotes, didn't get it right, close quotes, and shortly thereafter increased the presumptive penalty for domestic violence for a first-time offender to 6 games. Next, she says this, which never came out in the media accounts of this. Notably, after announcing this increased penalty under the policy, the commissioner called Rice to assure him that the new policy would not affect him, that it was forward-looking, and his penalty would not be increased. Then she says, then on September 8th, a video from the camera inside the elevator was aired publicly. And she goes on to say, after describing what the video says, that same day, alongside a furor of public outcry over the second video, the commissioner suspended Rice indefinitely. She goes on to say, before she gets into a further discussion of the facts, because after careful consideration of all the evidence, I am not persuaded that Rice lied to or misled the NFL at his June interview, I find that the indefinite suspension was an abuse of discretion and must be vacated. It is significant that she basically says that Rice received the video during his criminal case. The NFL knew about the criminal case, knew about the fact that there was another video, and never issued a request for that video. And moreover, after issuing the suspension to Rice of 2 games, it then amended its domestic violence policy to say that a first-time offender would get a 6-game suspension. And then Goodell, the commissioner, calls up Rice and says, but irrespective of that policy, we're not going to apply it to you retroactively. And it's only after purportedly that Goodell sees the second video that he rescinds the 2-game suspension and issues an indefinite suspension. So evidently, the NFL argued in this case that there was a misleading by Ray Rice at that pre-discipline meeting in June of this year, and that therefore had Goodell known about the severity of what happened in that elevator, he might have suspended him indefinitely then. But as the arbitrator finds, either he knew or he should have known what happened in that elevator, and there was therefore no new facts that were found and no new facts that came about, and that therefore the decision of the commissioner to indefinitely suspend Ray Rice was arbitrary in nature. And as a result of that, therefore, the suspension should have been no more than 2 games and an additional week's salary suspension. Now, in addition to the grievance that the NFL filed against the NFL Players Association filed against the NFL, there is now a hearing scheduled in February for Ray Rice's individual grievance against the Baltimore Ravens. And in that grievance, he's claiming that the Ravens violated their contract with Ray Rice in also breaking its contract and honoring the indefinite suspension, in which if Ray Rice wins, he'll get back pay for all of the season except for the 2 games and 1 week salary imposed by initially by the commissioner, and I think he's got a good chance of winning that as well. When you look at how the NFL dealt with this particular situation and investigation, again, it's instructive, and it's sort of the prototypical case of how not to conduct an investigation. Because after all, what the NFL could have done is they could have requested the second video and withheld judgment until it got all the facts in, looked at that video, and if it determined that in its view the second video reflected such an egregious action on the part of Ray Wright, very well have said that no, we are going to suspend him for the entire season. But they didn't do that. What they did was they made an initial determination, they then changed their policy, and then after they changed their policy and told Ray Rice that it was not going to be applicable to him, then they get the second video a little after Labor Day of this year and suspend him indefinitely, which goes to show you that if you're doing an investigation, and I said this in my first discussion of the Ray Rice case, it behooves you to get all the facts you possibly can, interview all the witnesses you possibly can, get all the documentary evidence or videos that you possibly can prior to the imposition of your discipline. Because generally you're going to be held to the standard of the information that you knew or should have known at the time of the discipline in assessing whether the discipline is appropriate or was appropriate at the time or inappropriate. And you're not going to be able to go back and gild the lily by saying, oh, but if I had known about the following facts, my decision would have been different. Rather, you're going to be held to the standard of what did you know or what should you have known at the time that you imposed the discipline. And if that means indefinitely suspending an employee or suspending an employee for a period of time during which you can gather more facts and evidence, then do it. The NFL would have been well advised, and believe me, Goodell had numerous attorneys that were advising him on this, and in my opinion, they all bungled it and got it wrong to their detriment. So I think it's an abject lesson in how not to conduct an investigation, and the NFL really, in my opinion, deserved what it got by virtue of Judge Jones' decision. Okay, as always, I invite any questions or comments you may have. If you do not want to ask them here, certainly you can ask them either by calling me at 410-209-6417 or by emailing me at hkerman@offutkerman.com. Any questions from anybody or comments? Okay, well, hearing none then, I would certainly issue to all of you a proclamation to enjoy your holiday season. Have a safe holiday and a happy and healthy new year. And we will be back together again the second Wednesday in January of 2015. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Howard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you,
okay,
everyone.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.